Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For 4.5 years, community and climate activists, healthcare workers, teachers, longshoremen, and first responders in the Portland-Vancouver region have been working hard to stop the largest oil-by-rail terminal in North America from being built at the Port of Vancouver, Washington. On January 29, 2018, their persistent organizing paid off when Washington State Governor Jay Inslee rejected the Tesoro Savage oil shipping terminal as, quote, not in the best interests of the state and its people. That afternoon, at least 100 activists and elected officials gathered across the street from Vancouver City Hall to celebrate.
Thank you, Governor Inslee!
Y'all excited to be here? Y'all excited to be here in the rain?
Yeah!
That's right, it just rain's not gonna stop us, but we are gonna stop an oil terminal. Yeah. And when I say we, my name is Bart Hansen, Vancouver City Council, and I wanna thank each and every one of you. You are the people that made this happen, period. Going out, knocking on doors, getting people elected, being at the meetings. Meetings till 2 o'clock in the morning, I might add. Thank you for doing what you do, because this is about you. This proves that nothing is bigger than the people that want to be a part of it. And in this case, the people that want to stop it. Thank you so, so much. And we're gonna continue doing what we're doing. There's no question about it. The fight's not ended. I mean, I hope it's over, but I'm planning on appeals and lawsuits. Because we're gonna keep fighting. And we're gonna keep fighting for Vancouver, our port, and what it means to us. If I end on anything, folks, I wanna end on this, and that is thank you. Each and every one of you.
I want to say thank you to Governor Inslee for making the right decision. You said no to dangerous increase in oil train traffic. You said no to an additional 50 million tons of CO2 that would be added to our atmosphere. You said no to an additional 230,000 pounds of toxic and hazardous chemicals that would be released into our air every year. You said no. Vancouver, and especially neighborhoods such as Fruit Valley, do not deserve to be sacrificed to higher rates of asthma, cancer, stroke, and heart disease. You said no to a powerful industry with a terrible safety record and disregard for the human cost of doing business as usual, a business that is stuck in the last century. Thank you, Governor Inslee, for listening to the people who submitted more than 1.3 million comments against the Tesoro Savage project. Thank you for saying no to this project that was wrong for Vancouver, wrong for the state of Washington, and wrong for the planet. And now, Governor, please help us move on to a renewable energy future by recognizing that natural gas is not a bridge fuel. I would like to introduce Linda Garcia, Fruit Valley Neighborhood Leader.
You guys have been amazing.
The last 5 years have been incredibly long and exhausting. And on my way over here today, I realized that this is the last time I'm gonna have to do this. And Fruit Valley, my beloved neighborhood, thanks everybody that worked so hard to get the job done. We fought, we walked, we knocked on doors. Spoke volumes to just about everybody that would listen to us and some that didn't really want to listen to us too. And our message was heard. And it's just a little, I told you, it's a little overwhelming. It's been a long 5 years and I'm glad I actually made it long enough to see this day happen. Thank you.
Thank you.
From the office of Jamie Pinkham, Executive Director, Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, dated January 29, 2018, Portland, Oregon. Today, the governor's decision on the Tesoro Savage oil terminal showed that the health of the Columbia River and the safety of its citizens matter most. The denial of Vancouver Energy's permit to build the largest oil-by-rail terminal in the nation is a decision that we all celebrate. Throughout the application process, the Yakima Nation, Umatilla Tribe, and the Kritvik vigorously asserted the interests of the Columbia River and those who depend on it. Today's denial is based on real risks to our communities in the Columbia River. We are pleased that Governor Inslee agreed with the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council's decision and formally stopped this project. Right on. However, we must remain vigilant. There are other challenges facing the Columbia River Basin, but today's victory shows us that they can be overcome when we work together. Niwichoni.
Today we celebrate with all those people you just heard who were in Vancouver at the City Hall last Monday, the near certain demise of this behemoth threat that has hung over the community since 2013. My guests are Linda Garcia, a neighborhood activist from the Fruit Valley neighborhood in Vancouver, just blocks from where the terminal would have been sited, and Regna Merritt with the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, one of the lead organizations in the fight to stop the terminal. Regna and Linda, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara.
And actually, Regna, I think the first time we ever talked was about Hanford, and then it was water, and it's been oil trains.
The Bull Run watershed. Yeah.
Right, so I feel like we've been going through a lot of struggles together. Linda, I think this is the first time you've actually been on the show, but Linda was featured in my documentary last summer, Sacrifice Zones, and you heard Linda's voice at the rally being very emotional, which is one of the things I really like about talking with Linda. It's been a very emotional fight. So I guess we can sort of raise a metaphorical champagne glass here.
You're here.
We're not really drinking on the air, but we're celebrating. This is a story that it's been a long time coming. And I think, to me, the thing that really struck me the most last Monday, actually, I was just about a week ago, I was sitting here checking email to try to find information for something I needed to make an announcement, and saw an email from Liz Terhar from Columbia River Keeper that the Jay Inslee had just come down with his decision to stop the terminal. And it was a pleasure to be able to announce it on the show, interrupting this very depressing guest I had. talking about how horrible everything was. And to think about that it wasn't a surprise, and yet when it came, it almost felt like a surprise. I want to first ask you both what it felt like to you when you got the news and how it reflects on the last 5 years of this struggle. So start with Linda.
Of course I cried. I guess, like everybody else, I was kind of numb at first. And after this many years, you kind of sit there in a state of disbelief and wait, did that really just happen? And you really, really want to believe it, but you want to wait until everybody else starts kicking in. And sure enough, within about 10 minutes, my phone started blowing up and people just, you know, oh my gosh, we did it. And let's get to this rally and let's make sure that we thank Governor Inslee for this, because we could still be fighting if it weren't for him.
Just think about all those Port Commission meetings you don't have to go to anymore.
Yeah, Port Commission meetings, City Council meetings, FSEC meetings, all of it.
So I would hope that the City Council would have a meeting where the community could come together just to breathe a collective sigh of relief, because the City Council was got quite involved in the struggle. What do you think? So let's back up a little bit. Regna, what was your response when you heard this?
I started dancing around the house, and I really, you know, what first came to my mind was, this is what democracy looks like. And it's so exciting when it works. You know, we had such a powerful coalition with amazing partners in the communities that would be most impacted, plus the communities all along the rail line kicking in and raising their voices through formal resolutions. We had the longshoremen there who realized that if there were an oil spill or an accident there, that it would shut down the entire port and everybody would lose their jobs. And then we had firefighters from the state of Washington. You know, it was just an amazing coalition that worked really well together, where there was a lot of trust. And in this Trumpian times, you know, it's ever more important that local politics prevail. And so the timing was really great too. We were overjoyed.
Well, I was thinking, the guy I had on the show last week, who was a very good interview subject, but he was very depressing. He was talking about the Department of Interior basically giving the keys of the kingdom to oil and gas and mining interests. And he was feeling through the whole show of like, this is just horrible and it's getting worse and there's nothing we can do. And then when I announced that the terminal had been shut down and I said, well, what does this say about the power of local action? He started talking about all these local battles about, particularly about Marcellus Shale that had been very effective. So I found it interesting to see that hearing this news inspired this person who was pretty pessimistic about being able to do anything on a federal level to remember, oh yes, we can still win on the local level. And that's mm-hmm. something that people were talking about all last year after Trump was elected. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the process. And Linda, I mean, you probably went to more meetings in the last 5 years than most people would go to in four or five lifetimes.
That's probably correct.
I wanted to talk about what it took, starting with your neighborhood, because you were really in the blast zone. And it was, first of all, how far do you live from where that facility would have been sited?
Less than half a mile.
Okay, that says it right there. So how did you organize, starting with your neighborhood and then with all the neighborhood associations to the point where people from Hood River to Spokane were also out supporting you?
Well, they brought the proposal to us first, and the neighborhood leaders within Fruit Valley spoke about it and did a lot of research, heard the PR pitch from Tesoro and Savage in the very beginning, and we weren't real happy with it. It was pretty obtuse. There were a lot of questions and a lot of concerns, and when we brought them back to Tesoro and Savage and the Port of Vancouver, we weren't getting the answers that we felt we deserved. We were being point blank about it, and they weren't. They were kind of sidestepping the issue, which we've all seen them do now for the last 5 years. And so I think everything just kind of morphed. We started out as this little neighborhood association and trying to fight the big giant. And little by little, groups like the Sierra Club and all of the other groups that were involved started hearing the news. And the more we put word out, the more support we ended up having, and from other neighborhood associations as well.
We're talking with Regna Merritt, who's with the Physicians for Social Responsibility here in Portland, and Linda Garcia, who's across the river from Portland in Vancouver, Washington, and was one of the neighborhood leaders for the Fruit Valley neighborhood, which was adjacent to, or is adjacent to, where this terminal would be built. We're talking about the demise of Vancouver Energy, the Tesoro Savage, largest in North America oil by rail terminal that was defeated last week in the final stages of being defeated by an edict from Governor Jay Inslee. Regna, you belong to one of the groups that became very vocal in opposing this and as opposing oil change in particular. And how did you find out about the terminal, and why did Physicians for Social Responsibility decide to take it on as such a big project?
Well, in addition to working for Oregon Physicians, I'm the Power Pass Coal co-lead, and we've been fighting for many years to stop coal export terminals up and down the West Coast, and have had a lot of success. So many of the same groups that are working on Power Pass Coal are working with the Stand Up to Oil Coalition, and these include Columbia River Keeper, Sierra Club, Friends of the Columbia Gorge. There are people from Greenpeace and 350 PDX. I mean, it's just a beautiful coalition, including One America in Vancouver, which, you know, they can address the minority population in places like Fruit Valley, which has one of the largest, it is probably the lowest income and the highest minority population in Vancouver.
That in itself speaks volumes about environmental
equity.
Justice and equity.
Absolutely.
And why these facilities are always placed next to communities of color and low-income communities.
And that's often the case with regard to the placement of the railroads, too. So this is an issue with huge long-term and short-term health impacts. And PSR brings the voice of medicine and public health, the values of medicine and public health, to the gravest threats of our time, and one of those is climate change. So, you know, it's clear that this is one of the worst emitters in the state of Washington and in the whole region. And when you look at the life cycle from the mines through the transportation to the storage to the export to the burning, it's just a disaster for the climate. So we were very concerned on that level. And then, as Linda stated, the direct impact to everyone along the line and in the neighborhoods like Fruit Valley. So we try and speak for not only public health and safety, but also for low-income minority populations, for children and the elderly, for those populations that are most vulnerable to both air pollution that would be generated, to the risks of explosion, and to climate change. So that's where why we decided to get involved and where we apply our expertise.
Well, Linda, when we first talked, which was probably what, 2 years ago, I think, you talked about how you had a lot of concerns about climate change, but when you first brought this issue up to your neighborhood association and when you were first talking to neighbors, the issue wasn't so much climate change as it was danger, basically, right, and pollution. Somehow, though, it seems like those two issues got more interconnected in people's lives and minds. And I wonder, what was the process where people started realizing this is not just a danger to myself, my family, my neighborhood, but it's a danger to the planet?
I think it took a couple of years to get to that point. For us in Fruit Valley, the number one concern was the VOCs that were going to be emitted that Regna...
Which are what?
Oh, volatile organic compounds. My bad. the Pacific Northwest. We love those initials. That was our greatest concern because from the moment that this terminal, the proposed terminal, would have gone online 24/7, we would have been subjected to those emissions. It would not have stopped. It would have continued burning all of that time.
And some of those volatile organic compounds are cancer causing.
Yes. Yes.
Benzene and toluene.
Cancer causing and creating more issues for people who have asthma or any type of chronic lung disease, heart disease, all of those things wrapped into one. And so our biggest concern, Fruit Valley has historically been a marginalized low-income community. And just to clarify, the Port of Vancouver sits within the Fruit Valley neighborhood boundaries. We always want to make sure that people understand that they are inclusive in that. And we never really had problems with them before. We always worked very well together, their leadership and our leadership. If there were any concerns, then those concerns were brought back to the port, and they worked with us, with all of the businesses that are seated within the port locally. This was the first time that we had a problem with them actually hearing what we were saying. So I think it just kind of wrapped all into one. People got more concerned about those emissions that were coming out. And, you know, my mantra became, there's not an invisible wall at Fruit Valley. They're not going to get to that wall and shut down. They were going to continue out across Vancouver and Clark County.
And the volatile organic chemicals also, they have an immediate impact on health, as Linda was saying. They, when combined with heat, cause smog, which, you know, it's just an incredible and harmful health impact in the short term and the long term. So it magnifies any of the impacts that we're having from a warming climate and a warming planet, too. And you can see on smoggy days that people, there's an increase in heart attacks, there's an increase in strokes, emergency room visits, in addition to all the problems with people with asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease.
Well, it seemed to me that the Tesoro Savage Terminal had some interesting coincidental PR problems, because as it was being voted on by the port to vote on approving this lease with Tesoro Savage, which would be gave them access to the port to build this facility, what happened, Linda, out across the country?
Which time?
Oh, well, actually, I was thinking of Lac-Mégantic, the first really big oil train explosion that made international news.
It kind of coincided within our timeline. there was that. There was the explosion at Anacortes. There was the accident in California. Everything just started happening as the issue, our local issue, became more prominent. both in the press and among the community.
So the volatility increased, so to speak.
Yes, it did. We started seeing more and more train incidents as well. So then it became, because for a good visual, Fruit Valley is separated from the rest of the city of Vancouver by a set of railroad tracks. So it became more of an issue for us in that respect as well. It wasn't just focused on the air quality. It was always about air quality for us. But then when we started seeing more and more train accidents occurring, then it just became a nightmare.
Well, another thing that became very apparent was that communities up and down the tracks between yes. Spokane and Vancouver were all coming together and opposing the terminal because they recognized how much it was going to increase train traffic, which is one thing we haven't mentioned, is how many trains were going to go through a day if the terminal
would go. I think five trains a week, is that it? No, five a day.
Five trains a day.
As opposed to four a week or whatever.
Right, five unit trains per day, which is 180 cars.
And a unit right. train is just a train that's all carrying the same
right,
stuff.
And they can be a mile and a third long, a mile and a half long. So they block at grade crossings, and that was one of the key concerns of Multnomah County and the city of Portland when they wrote their letters, their comment letters, and passed their resolutions, because it was going to hinder access for emergency responders, fire trucks, police cars. And that was one of the obvious problems. The other one being an explosion like we saw in Mosier. Right. So Mosier was a huge turning point as well, a real eye-opener, because while it could have been so much worse, we still had a huge toxic plume burning and destruction of the city's wastewater system. People lost their water for drinking for days. And it was just like a little glimpse of what could have happened. That also helped educate elected officials and people in general about the incredible threats associated with bringing all these trains through.
Well, a couple days before the Mosier explosion, I was interviewing Jared Larrabee, who is the spokesperson for Savage, which is the, I'm not sure, I think one of those horses, theatrical horses, with this person in the front, the person in the back. I'm not sure which Savage was, the head or the back of the horse. And he had said in the interview that they were going to do, the utmost to make sure that it was as safe as possible. They guaranteed its safety, and everything was state-of-the-art. So right after the explosion happened in Mosier, I emailed him and wanted to know if they wanted to make a statement about this, because I thought the timing was really interesting just in terms of the interview that we just done. And he actually didn't email me back, but somebody from Tesoro actually emailed me back and said, this is really, we can't make a statement, this is really the responsibility of the railroads. So I think, besides the sleaziness of that, it also shows the danger when you're having such hazardous cargo being transported such long distances, that there's really no chain of responsibility because they kept passing it off on each other. And I think right. that showed up in Mosier during the cleanup.
Mm-hmm. Well, to give our listeners some context, we're talking about 360,000 barrels of oil a day. That's a tremendous amount. There's about 40 gallons in every barrel, and we're talking 360,000 barrels a day. So this would have been the largest oil by rail facility in the nation, maybe in the world. And fortunately, we were able to mobilize fierce opposition and win.
Well, I just wanted to do a little shout out because we have to talk now about what comes next. But I wanted to just do a little shout out to every community that you guys were in touch with along the Columbia River and what their input was to this.
I mean, we had everybody from states far away to, you know, locally here, Spokane, all the way down the river. Going back to Mosier was, that was a difficult piece for a lot of us here. Ironically, when the accident happened in Mosier, many of us, I'm not sure if you were there with us that day or not, right? Yeah, we had just finished testifying before the NTSB.
Which
and the National Transportation Safety Board regarding oil train safety. And they had brought their meeting to Vancouver for us to participate in. And it was maybe 20 minutes after the majority of us were done testifying, and word started trickling in, and everybody from Tesoro Savage ran from the room, and we started getting news. And the next day, a large contingency of us went up to Mosier from Vancouver. We knew the risk. We knew the threat. but to actually see it and to see what had happened was very overwhelming. And I think it kind of made many of us realize this could be our lives. And so we wanted to be incredibly supportive of Mosher. And at the same time, people from Mosher were contacting us and saying, this is enough. We're done. What can we do to help you? So in their time of need, they turned around and helped us, which was amazing. The community support and rallying around each of them was outstanding.
Well, I remember the Columbia River tribes too really stepped up at Mosher to join forces, join hands.
But actually, the tribes had been involved for quite a while before that in opposing the oil trains.
Yes, yeah, so they were.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about the tribe input, because that they have a different kind of standing than the rest of us. They actually have sovereign nation standing. So
they do. They have the water rights along the river, and a lot of their livelihood relies upon the water and the Columbia River, and any type of spill in there endangers not just their food, but their lives, their employment, everything.
I remember Paul Lemnis, who was at that time the head of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, and he gave a really moving speech at the rally in Hood River the day after the Mosher explosion.
He did. The tribes have been just incredible, and because of their involvement, we've also been able to stave off Union Pacific's proposed project to double track around Mosher. So, you know, in the immediate aftermath of this disaster, they're moving ahead with plans to make it easier for more oil trains to move faster. And so the tribe stepped up in legal challenges that we supported as well with the Friends of Columbia Gorge. And at this point, we've staved off that too. So they're operating in multiple arenas to save us from fossil fuels and to protect treaty rights and fishing rights, including fishing rights.
And we'll get a little bit more into that a bit later when we talk about what's up next. This morning, if you're just tuning in, we're talking with Regna Merritt, who is with Physicians for Social Responsibility Oregon chapter, and Linda Garcia, a leader in the Fruit Valley neighborhood in Vancouver, Washington, who was very vocal and probably much more than vocal. I mean, on every level that one can be active, Linda and her neighbors worked.
She became a citizen scientist in
right.
the process.
And we're talking today about the recent victory of all these people who spent almost 5 years fighting the oil by rail terminal in Vancouver that was proposed for Vancouver, which was shot down last week by Governor Inslee. Besides stopping the terminal, which was a big feat in itself, there were a lot of other issues that rose up and actions that were taken. And it seems to me that we're a lot inspired, if maybe totally inspired, by this proposed terminal. And I wanted to talk about ordinances that were passed in Vancouver, in Portland, Multnomah County, Hood River, and how they were affected by this fight to stop the terminal. So let's start with Vancouver, actually, because I think Vancouver passed the first ordinance.
Yes, and we realized going into that ordinance meeting that City Council held that it would have no good outcome on what we were fighting. Everything had already fallen into place for that and had been turned into FSEC. So,
And what is FSEC?
FSEC is, you're going to test me on this one. Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council.
You got it, right. You get the gold star.
Gee, thanks. You'd think that would be more ingrained in my brain right now. It was more for the future because they saw what happened and they were trying to put the brakes on anything that might come ahead because we did see some other local businesses come forward and try and slide in under the radar since the Tesoro project was so large. They thought maybe they could get some special dispensation regarding some smaller proposed projects. So the City of Vancouver really stepped it up. There was a special City Council meeting held. They actually took it to the Hilton Hotel Convention Center because there were so many people anticipated, and I believe the number was somewhere over 800. And we testified, and we sat there until 2:30 in the morning until City Council made that decision to stop any further proposed projects from coming into the city.
Well, actually, a while after that, I went to a Vancouver City Council meeting where they're actually, I guess, I'm not sure if they were confirming that vote or if it was a different, even further one. But it was a few months after the 2:30 in the morning meeting.
It could have been a different one. They did vote on it that evening or that morning.
I think they went further. It was like to block all future.
Oh right, yeah. Right.
Let's finish the sentence. All future fossil fuel infrastructure.
Right.
So similar to what Portland had passed a little earlier. So, Regna, I think I saw you. I'm not maybe sure. Like once a month. For a couple of years there, at all these different hearings. And one place I saw you a lot was at City Hall. So let's talk a little bit about how Portland, the city of Portland was inspired, maybe frightened, into passing an ordinance that really changed what can happen in terms of infrastructure for fossil fuels here.
The city of Portland early on took a position against coal trains coming through the city. And so they were primed and had a good understanding of what could happen with oil trains, which, you know, presented an even greater immediate threat of explosion and fire. So Mayor Hales was in charge at the time. And when PSR approached the city and asked the city to take And Commissioner Fritz, I must say, has been a champion in all these arenas. They were happy to take it on. In the context of a previously defeated struggle for the largest propane export facility in the county and in the city, the mayor was eager to show leadership and
initially
supported right. The Pembina proposal. He came to understand the importance of the threat to the city's well-being, economic stability, and the health and safety of its citizens. So shortly, like perhaps a week after the resolution on the oil spoke against the movement of oil trains through the city of Portland and through Vancouver. So it was specifically targeting this Tesoro Savage project. A week after that, there was action taken to more broadly oppose the transfer and storage of fossil fuels. Subsequent to that, there was an election and Mayor Wheeler followed through on the resolution about no new fossil fuel infrastructure to implement some zoning ordinances, which could turn that from, pretty language into real protections for citizens of Portland. There's a long story there, and that was appealed, and we can go into that some other time.
Right. But we've been covering that for several years.
But the oil trains were a big deal and remained a big deal. Became a bigger deal after Mosier with the city council. And I also want to thank Multnomah County and Chair Kafori and the sustainability folks there who took the time. They have expertise to actually determine who lives near the tracks and which businesses, which schools, which daycares. And they came up with a number to look at, they wouldn't call it a sacrifice zone, but we would. And, you know, nearly a quarter of the city of Portland's population lives within that sacrifice zone if an oil train were to derail and explode. There are 106 schools, 100 daycare centers, and you can just imagine the value of all that property that would be at risk with a derailment and an explosion. Furthermore, and this is keeping with the fact that we need to pay attention to equity and justice here, there would have been a disproportionate impact on communities of color, especially the Black population in Portland.
Well, I think that when people were focusing on this terminal in Vancouver, some people didn't realize that a lot of those trains on their way to Vancouver were going to pass through Portland.
Absolutely.
Because there's railroad tracks on either side of the gorge.
That's true.
And I remember being at a number of hearings and rallies of people who lived in the Cully neighborhood, which, I mean, they can basically see the tracks from where they live. And
yes.
Columbia Riverkeeper did this interesting performance, or they sponsored this performance piece, Notes of the Columbia Riverkeeper, piece by
Holcomb Waller.
Holcomb Waller last fall. And I remember going to the show, which is this funny little theater called the Headwaters, I think. And it's right on the tracks. And there was this tanker train that looked like it was carrying oil. And we were all like sitting through Holcomb's performance, just like really nervous. And it turned out it was vegetable oil. But I think that really brought it home that this is how close it comes in Portland as well as Vancouver.
Right, and those oil trains move through the Columbia Gorge, and then they can move north through Portland toward Vancouver and to Anacortes, for example, and they can go south through Salem, Eugene, near Klamath Falls, to refineries in California. They're also going down the Deschutes River, upstream through Bend. So there's still huge threats and no accountability for the safety of communities near those tracks now. And that's one of the things we're trying to fix in the Oregon legislature starting this week.
Well, we'll talk about that a bit. Actually, I'm spending a lot of time now driving up to Kalama and Longview because I'm working on a project now about the proposed Kalama methanol refinery. And something we'll talk about at the end of the show. But I noticed the last two times I've gone up to Kalama that there's these trains, and they're not unit trains, but there are these oil tankers that are part of these trains. And so this problem, it seems to me that I'm not sure if they're running fewer unit trains than they used to, but I thought, well, now you're trying to hide these oil tankers in these mixed-use trains. And let's talk about the continuing danger of having oil trains going through, well, anywhere in the world, basically, and what's being done to stop that.
There's still a tremendous amount of oil moving on our tracks in Washington and Oregon, and in both states, there are legislative efforts to try and increase safety. And a lot of that is just forcing the oil companies and the railroad companies, really, to report what they're carrying. In Oregon, there's a bill called House Bill 4004. It's being heard at the Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee this Thursday on February 8th at 3 p.m. in Hearing Room E. And I encourage people to go online to the Oregon Legislative Information System. It's also called OLIS, to watch the hearings or to submit testimony. That's even more important. But we have the worst laws on the West Coast. We're woefully behind in Oregon, and we need an increased capacity to respond to emergencies, and we need increased accountability from the railroads. Last year, the railroads kind of hijacked a good bill, and so we have to turn out in force on Thursday to pass a bill that will actually protect human health and safety.
What was the bill last year that they hijacked?
The bill last year started out very much the same as this year, but it came at the end of the day to protect the privacy and interests of the railroad over the interests of the public. So we're going to work with Barbara Smith Warner to make sure that that doesn't happen again this year.
So the other thing that is of concern is the rest of the fossil fuel cycle, that we've gotten a lot of buy-in from our elected officials around stopping coal and oil. And right now, Kate Brown and Jay Inslee are in the forefront of trying to stop offshore oil drilling off the Pacific Northwest coast, and support them wholeheartedly. But there's this other fossil fuel that people seem to tout sometimes as the clean bridge fuel to the future of renewables. And on the little clip that we heard at the beginning of the show, Ilona Steinke, who she and her husband Don were major leaders in fighting the oil terminal, she talks about how it's time to turn our focus to natural gas, or frack gas, as we're calling it now, and to look at the fact that that is not a clean bridge fuel. So how do we see the success that we've had in stopping, I guess this is it. I mean, this is the last coal or oil terminal that's being proposed in the Northwest, as far as I'm aware of. Is that true?
There's still there are ongoing threats with oil in Washington State. And we can't forget that there's also a facility, Global Partners, near Clatskanie and Port Westward, which, when the price of oil goes up again, could easily convert back to moving oil. And that would that's a real threat for us. But there's also facilities. Tesoro is in Washington trying to expand a xylene facility, and we're concerned that might be a bait and switch when it's because a xylene facility looks a lot like an oil by rail facility, and so we're trying to ensure that that has a lot of scrutiny and legal defense as well.
I agree. Right now, there's a lot of work. Several people are in contact with Vancouver City Council members, trying to look into a broader climate action plan. And, you know, I guess it's true, the expression, shoot for the moon, land in the stars, if that's what we need to do to create those smaller local level conversations that, again, just like what happened with Tesoro Savage, then they can branch out. The more focus we give to each thing that comes in, the more attention gets put onto that. As far as I've had so many people tell us, I myself am sitting here waiting for the other shoe to drop. It hasn't quite sunk in yet. I'm still not convinced. You know, they have 30 days to appeal. There's the March 31st deadline with the Port of Vancouver. So people
What's that March 31st deadline?
As of March, because the commissioners voted earlier this month to not continue the lease with Tesoro. And the next time that lease evaluation comes up would be in March. So, but people have brought concern and said, what happens now? So Vancouver's out of the question. That's not stopping Tesoro from coming somewhere else in Washington State. My thought is they've already been through the FSEC process in Washington State one time. Governor Inslee has already turned it down once. I don't feel like that they would propose a brand new terminal, but like Regna said, there are other options for. And I wouldn't put it past them for a bait and switch. So there are things like that that are going on that I think a greater plan and even more ordinances need to be sought and need to be created and implemented.
Well, we're talking today about the demise of the Vancouver Energy Oilwell Rail Terminal in Vancouver, Washington, last week with the help of Governor Inslee, who basically vetoed it. And my guests are Linda Garcia with the Fruit Valley Neighborhood Association in Vancouver, and Regna Mero with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. I was thinking about another thing that changed politically in the course of the struggle, and that's the Vancouver port. And this, I'm wondering, could not this be a role model for other communities? So, Linda, talk about what happened at the port. We, in the little audio clip, we heard all this car horn honking and people cheering, and you might have heard somebody say, "Don Orange," if you listened closely.
Yes. So the port over the last few years has been overturned. There are three commissioners that sit there. Prior to this last November, there was always a 2-to-1 vote. Two of the commissioners were always on board with Tesoro and wanted to see the FSEC process continue regardless of things that were happening along the side. In November almost a full year before, a campaign was undertaken by Don Orange and his entire team. It was a grassroots, amazing effort. It was the largest money race that we've ever seen here locally, with the oil company pouring in, I believe, $750,000 to the opposition's campaign.
And his name, interestingly, was Green.
And his name was Green.
Talk about greenwashing.
But it's important to note that it was that grassroots effort behind him that pushed him to that amazing overturn. I don't even remember the percentage number, but I believe it was somewhere along 58 or 63%.
61, I think, to 37. Yeah.
Yeah. So that spoke volumes to what the people actually wanted. And when people turn out to vote like that, and it is a larger number, you have to look at that. You can't just sidestep it. So now, as of November's election and as of the time that Don Orange was sworn in, it's a 2-to-1 vote in the opposite favor. And it looks like from this point forward, there will be more agency over that. There will be more environmental concern and maybe a little bit more regulation and looking at things that would possibly come through that could be harmful to the community.
Well, a few weeks ago, I had Eric DePlace from Sightline on, and he's a perpetual optimist with very, very rare exceptions. And what he likes to do is go through the litany of all the fossil fuel projects that have been defeated in the Northwest. And so despite your concerns, Regna, about these two possibilities of being bait and switch to oil terminals waiting in the shadows to pop up again, I think it's important to remember that the community's a hoquiam. Correct me, I think that was an oil by rail project, right?
There were two. There were two projects that were stopped.
And then there were projects stopped up north of Bellingham. I mean, it was, and there's a coal project. I guess it was a coal.
We stopped five out of the six coal export projects. Right. The one that's remaining is in British Columbia.
Right. Yeah. And of course, we stopped the coal export project on the Oregon side of the Columbia River.
That's right.
So, I mean, and it goes on and on. And then the Millennium Coal Project, which is the last big one that's in Longview, is on life support. Mm-hmm. I don't even think it's life support anymore. I think it's waiting to just kind of die at this point. But they did file an appeal.
Right. Yeah. There's a big legal battle. Yeah, ongoing.
But it seems like
we're confident.
And I know that Eric likes to say that the Northwest is a region where fossil fuel projects come to die. So there is some truth to that. But I think that in the remaining part of the show, I want to talk about some of the future challenges. And I felt from what both Don and Alwona Sankey said at the rally last week, and what my experience is spending a lot of time in Klamath lately, is that the big threat now is frack gas. And I want to talk a little bit about how we build the same kind of coalition that have been built around oil trains and coal terminals and oil terminals to address the issue of fracked gas in this region. And what are some of the big proposals that the region is facing?
Well, we are working on development of a new regional coalition similar to the Power Pass Coal and Stand Up to Oil coalitions. There's a lot of excitement around it because of the huge amount of natural gas that's coming into our region and for export, much of it for export. As you referenced, the struggle in Klamath is at hand. This would be the largest methanol refinery and export facility in the world. And there are many health impacts associated, with bringing all this methane gas into this small community. And, we're talking about, if you've driven on I-5 and you've passed Klamath, you see that, yes, it's serviced by railroads too. And those are where the oil trains go. Those are where the coal trains would go. And there's already a substantial amount of air pollution there that we need to get a handle on. We don't need to make that worse. We need to help make that better.
There's
an opportunity because there was a legal victory and a grassroots victory when the state of Washington decided they have to revisit the whole environmental impact statement process there. It's opened up again, and we're in the course of a 30-day comment period right now, and there's a huge opportunity, which we can talk about the times and places for people to get involved. There will be no public hearing per se yet, but this is for those of you who have come to know and understand, perhaps hate the environmental impact statement process. This is part of scoping. So this is where we identify all the issues that can impact that community and the state of Washington and the world with this huge project that's promoted by the Chinese government for the benefit of the Chinese.
So let's talk about a couple meetings that people can go to in the next few weeks to address. Well, basically to learn how to make the comments for scoping.
So next Tuesday, February 13th, at the Sierra Club, 1825 Southeast Ankeny. There'll be a presentation by Jasmine Zimmerstucky from Columbia Riverkeeper about this project in Kalama. And if people want to some good tools to learn how to make write effective comments, they'll be available to you there. It's probably 7 o'clock, but I'm not sure. You can go to Columbia Riverkeeper or to Oregon PSR and get the details. And then there'll be an event in Kalama as well.
Right. There's going to be one in Kalama on the 19th of February at 6 o'clock at the community it's at the community center. And it's at 216 Elm Street in Kalama. And actually, when you get off the city center exit of Kalama, I'm starting to know my way around there, but it's like right off of the main drag when you go up. So it's pretty easy to find. And if you're interested in going up to Kalama, I mean, it's a very interesting community to get to know. And it's a place that I, like probably many other Portlanders and maybe even Vancouverites, kind of drove through on your way to Seattle. And I used to look up the hill and see these really cool Victorian houses. And think, what a nice community. And then a few years later, I started noticing on the right side as you're heading south that there's all this industrial stuff going on. And that's where the methanol refinery would be. It would be on the west side of the freeway. But there's a really active community. And I think maybe in the kind of formative stages of developing a real strong social movement as Vancouver was 5 years ago. So they've been fighting this methanol refinery for a couple of years now.
They have. The mayor's opposed to it.
Yeah, they have a new mayor. It's another thing to kind of throw out that there's changes in electorate that are going on all over the region. And after Don Orange was elected and changed the composition of the Vancouver Port Commission, actually in the same election, I guess, the mayor switched in Kalama. And this guy ran on his whole platform was to stop the methanol refinery and other things that were like to have really encourage Kalama to be a green and livable place.
Right, there's a new McMinimum's opening up there too. So that's the kind of vision that the people of Kalama have for their community, not a huge, dirty, dangerous methanol.
I think when we talk about grassroots, we have to include that political piece, because people can do so much. You know, we can rally and we can support and we can get our voices heard, but they're heard far more clearly and far more reaching when you have the local politicians behind you and they're hearing the voice of the constituents and then they're taking that word further. So I think it's kind of just a big growing change of everything inclusive of that.
And I guess one of the reasons why I would urge people in Portland to look north a little bit and get to know their neighbors to the north, I really had my mind totally switched about what Vancouver's like when I started going over to Vancouver and seeing how much it's developing and turning into a very conscious place.
Yes.
And I think the same thing is starting to happen up north. And so people, especially in Kalama and Longview, they need our support here because they don't have the media outlets. They don't have the recognition.
They don't have the newspaper.
They don't have a newspaper.
They have this Columbian.
They have this very right-wing newspaper in Longview, and the Columbian barely reaches. I mean, we don't have a newspaper in Portland to speak of anymore either. But the Columbian's a good paper.
Yes.
So I think that it's really important for us to forge alliances with our neighbors to the north and our neighbors to the south. And we'll be talking in the next few weeks about all kinds of other energy issues, including down in Jordan Cove and Coos Bay. So I think it's really important that we are aware of what's happening region-wide.
It is. Community support is one of the biggest pushes that we had. If we hadn't had the support behind us, we would have been the lowly little neighborhood that was continually fighting against David David Sling the giant. You know, we were constantly in battle. And if we had not had that extra support from everybody that came in, I'm not sure we would be where we are today.
And you have any final words, Regna?
Well, for me, as someone who's been an organizer for decades, this has been one of the most exciting coalitions ever. And we're going to bring that power and movement building to the next battle.
It's always nice to win at least one of them in a while. I want to thank you both for joining us. This morning with Regna Merritt, who is with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Linda Garcia, who's a Vancouver neighborhood activist. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and LPFG KPFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Diane Dix about the proposed methanol refinery in Kalama, which we just mentioned a little bit. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by the great musician and human rights activist Hugh Masekela, who passed away last week or 2 weeks ago. We're going to listen to one of his hopeful songs. Thanks for listening.
I want to be there when the people start to turn it around, when they triumph over poverty. I want to be there when the people win the battle against AIDS. I want to lend a hand. I want to be there for the alcoholic. I want to be there for the drug addict. I want to be there for the victims of violence and abuse. I want to lend a hand. Send to mommy now.
City.